Hi everyone, this is Klaatu, and this is episode 4 of Season X, and it's going to be a great episode because I have lots of cool things in store for you. First, as always, we're going to do a fortune of the day. So the fortune for today is... Why be difficult when with a little bit of effort you could be impossible? I think it's a very nice motivational statement to start out with, because the thing, believe it or not, these are actual fortunes. Like these, I type in fortune and that's what we get each time. And sometimes it fits with the episode, and that one somehow it just kind of fits with this episode in my mind. So the thing that I want to talk about right up front, and it's a little bit of a response again to some listener feedback and kind of my own feedback on the previous episode, or is it the episode before that? I don't remember. But at some point I was talking about packaging for Linux and how it can be difficult, and how Linus himself famously started a project called Subsurface and has stated publicly at DebConf 2014, and just by virtue of the fact that Subsurface is not available packaged for Linux, that it's difficult to package things for Linux. Well before Linus started talking about that and kind of put it into people's minds, I had noticed that there were some poorly packaged things out there. Once again, the problem only happens on closed source stuff. But that's a valid complaint, right? So packaging for Linux, I agree, can be complex. And it can be done really, really well, or it can be done badly. And the most oft-cited problem is that underlying libraries can change, and therefore they break the code that you are distributing. And it's not really an issue with open source, because those underlying libraries, if they change and they break your code, then all you do is recompile. And I think when Linux started out, I'm imagining, I don't go this far back in reality to, you know, with Linux, but I think when it started out, that was the model. Yeah, it's everything is distributed. And Dan Washko from the Linux Link Tech Show said this as well on a show or something. I remember hearing him say this, and it was really, really insightful, I thought. And he said, quote, or paraphrasing, there is a universal format for distributing applications for Linux. It's source code. And that, I mean, on one hand, that sounds absolutely crazy, because everyone's all about, oh, let's make everything really easy for the noobs, and let's somehow making things easy for noobs also means you have to, you know, come up with package formats that they can just click on and it'll just install. And admittedly, that is nice. It's a nice feature to have. In practice, there are problems with that. Whereas with source code, in theory, you distribute your source code. Someone downloads it, they do the compile incantation, whether it's ./configure or cmake.dot or, you know, whatever it is, scons, whatever, and then they do the make, and then the make install, or some intermediary step there, and it makes things really simple, because it just compiles the code against whatever it has updated to break the other stuff. And that, in theory, works pretty darn well. And when I say in theory, I guess I really mean in practice. That's how I live my life. Slackware is not a source code distributed distribution, but a lot of the applications on top of Slackware that you end up installing, you just download the source code and you compile it. You compile it into a destination directory, and then you install that package. And it's that simple, generally speaking. Admittedly, that sometimes falls apart when, you know, you just, I don't know, let's say you just have to have the most recent version of, let's say, well, let's say Caden Live, the video editor, because that's a big, scary application with lots of dependencies. So let's say you just have to have the most recent version of that. And in order to get the most recent version of that, of course, you would need also the most recent version, let's say, of FFmpeg and MLT and all these other things. And maybe they depend on other things. So you start getting sort of signs of, like, dependency hell, as they call it. Now, I say that, but in practice, I can't actually recall me personally ever experiencing that. I will admit that sometimes you do have to go back a few levels and recompile the thing that, you know, recompile, let's say, FFmpeg. Although, again, this is a bad example because I don't actually remember ever having this problem. But let's say I did. I would recompile FFmpeg and then recompile MLT and then recompile Caden Live. And then I'm done. So it doesn't, you know, it's not a one-click kind of thing. That said, it still works. It works pretty darn well in my experience. The advantage to that model is that, as Dan Washko said, it's basically a universal format. You distribute the source code and people can deal with that. It's not, you don't have to give out an RPM or a deb or a Slackware package and, you know, whatever else is out there. You just distribute the source code. It's done. Another advantage is that the download sizes tend to be small in those events, because if you are only distributing your source code, then it's as big as it is, and all those other dependencies that your application requires in order for it to run and do its magic, that's distributed elsewhere, and maybe it's already on the person's computer, so they don't have to re-download that. So that's nice. That's a nice feature. And it's also pretty flexible, this idea of just releasing source code. Programmers can blindly release the source code, in theory, either a user or, in the current model, it tends to be more like a packager who is an intermediary between the source code and the user. They can package it up, give it to the user, and then they can install. And or you can just send out the source code and the user can do it themselves. You know, I mean, there's a lot of flexibility there. It's just kind of built in because that's the most basic way of distributing application code in source code. I would say that sometimes, and I think I said this in the other episode that I'm referring to that I can't remember which one it was, there, you know, obviously are problems. Like I say, sometimes the idea of compiling seems really easy, but if the user doesn't know what they're doing, then that can be problematic because they try to compile and then they get a bunch of errors and they have no idea why, and it's usually because they haven't installed the required library or whatever. But I mean, there are exceptions to that. Sometimes you download source code that hasn't been updated in a long time, and or that was badly written, not badly written, I mean maybe badly written, but source code that maybe isn't configured correctly or whatever, or expects a different configuration. How's that? So you do you start the compile and it's asking you, well, I don't know where your include path is for some reason. It should know, but it doesn't know for whatever reason, or something like that. So there's actually a real life example which we'll look at today is the scripts, the make files, haven't been written for multi-lib environments and just keep insisting on sending stuff to user lib instead of user lib 64 or something like that. A normal user isn't going to know how to fix that problem. Now that said, a normal user also isn't going to know what happens when they, you know, click to install an RPM or a .deb file and something goes wrong with it. You know, whether it's can't find this repository in order to install this dependency or whatever. There are problems when installing software sometimes. It happens in real life. It happens on all platforms. Other platforms have it a little bit easier because there is such standardization by force of being closed, really, that there's just not that many variables as to what a platform is going to have on it. You know, you just know that's my target. The vendor says that it shipped with these things. That's what I'll go for. More on that in a moment. Don't let me forget that. So the other problem is that packagers are sometimes slow to update stuff. So that has happened. I've mentioned, I think, earlier in a previous episode that LMMS, Linux Multimedia Studio, was at 0.4 in a lot of repositories when I was looking for it, and it's up to 1.0 right now. Granted, they may have skipped over a couple of numbers. You know how projects do that. But, I mean, 0.4 and 1.0, that's a pretty big delta, and it's a significant delta in terms of user experience. So that's a problem with the idea that, okay, we'll just release to the world and let intermediaries deal with it between, you know, the user and us. So that can be a problem. And there's sometimes not necessarily an easy answer to that, although there is something called check install. And check install I was introduced to on Debian initially. And I think it's a very underrated project. And check install, I thought it was just a Debian thing, and it turns out that it's actually not just a Debian thing. You can use check install so that when you're doing your source code install, you do your configure, your make, and then instead of doing a make install, you do a check install. And you can actually roll from that, from a package that has just been compiled on your system successfully. So theoretically, at that point, you should be able to run that binary from well, maybe not, because it might need to put stuff in different paths. But you know, you've got the binary sitting there in the folder, ready to be sent out to your system. So instead of doing the make install, you do check install, and you can roll with check install a .deb package, a .rpm package, or a Slackware package. So that's worth checking out if you've not used it. I mean, like I say, I've used it on Debian, and I, for the longest time, I thought it was just a Debian thing. But if you go to asic-linux, that's asic-linux.com.mx/tildeizto/checkinstall/index.php, you can download it and try it out yourself. It might be in your repository too, so maybe check there first. But it's a really cool little package, little cool application that is that gives you a lot of options when you are installing from source, because now you can track, you know, it becomes a package, so your system becomes aware of that as a thing. You can remove it easily, and it'll pick up all the pieces that it installed along with that binary. So it's really, really nice. Check that out for sure. Okay. Now, non-open source can be even more problematic. That's really, I would say, ultimately, that's the spanner in the works. That's the thing that really screws all this up. And I think that Linux, as I said in the very early beginning, they were assuming that its users would be able to compile from source. I have to be honest, I think users can still compile from source. It saddens me that we just assume that modern computer users are going to refuse to learn how to just do a simple compile. I don't know why that's just a programmer thing. I mean, I do know. It's because these OS vendors have conditioned people that is old and unfashionable and too technical for them. You know, I mean, why? I don't know. And I understand sometimes when you compile source code, there will be problems. And I will admit, some of those problems are really, really hard to fix. But I think, and it does complicate matters that there are so many Linux distributions out there with different things going on in them that can complicate things. But I don't know that source compiles have to be a bad thing all the time. And it's too bad that that's what we've told users, that, oh, you should never have to compile source code. That's, you know, that's scary and beneath you. You should just click on this button and it should just install. And I admit it's very nice to have that one-click installer. I love one-click installers. I really do. I praise the, PCBSD has this really nice and easy install wizard type of thing. I mean, those are really nice, and they're really fast, and they're easy. But I honestly believe that the way that Slackware with Slack builds, I mean, that's compiling from source as well. BSD is, ports. It compiles from source. And it doesn't have to be ugly. It doesn't have to be scary. And it can be what's the word? Vetted? Is that the word? There are no failed compiles because it's vetted through someone who's compiled it and tested it on whatever distribution they're managing, and it works. It simply works because all you're doing is running their script that has been proven. So I think that's a really great answer to all of that. The problem really starts to happen with closed source software, where the vendor, I've noticed this a long time ago, before I really even was thinking about Linux packaging as such. But I mean, sometimes the vendor doesn't understand Linux well enough to know how to package something for Linux. And this is a little bit surprising, but I noticed it on, it was a game, I think, that I had downloaded from the Humble Indie, or Humble Bundle. And it ran, the day you purchase it, it runs fine, and then you update something, or you upgrade, or you switch distributions, or whatever, and suddenly it's not working anymore. And I simply noticed, it was very simple, but I noticed that they'd counted on a very, very specific library being present on the target computer. And you update, and that target, that library rather, goes away, and so the game is looking for that very, very specific version of that library, and it stops working. And it was not a common library, if I recall correctly. It was something that really, really probably should have been sort of, I mean, if it was that important, it should have been bundled with the game. So it kind of struck me right, when I was looking at the sort of the error messages, it struck me that they didn't know how to package for Linux. They didn't understand really what they could count on being on an install and what would change over time. So that was something that kind of made me aware that a lot of the closed source vendors who, especially with the Humble Bundle, which started out, if you recall, as being staunchly multi-platform, and nowadays it seems like they've kind of thrown that out the window, as you do. But I think a lot of some of the games that were early on in the Humble Bundles, they would be released for Linux because they had to be, because Humble Bundle was enforcing that at the time, and they ended up kind of clearly hacking a package together that just wouldn't last. And that's a pity. That's really too bad. So if you rely on the vendor to fix these things, then obviously it's not going to work because they don't really understand the platform that they're using, or that they're targeting, rather. Whereas obviously if there was some openness to that process, then distribution maintainers could probably help out with that. But that's just not, closed source doesn't really play along with that model. And I mean, they're closed source. I mean, why should they, really? I mean, why should we expect them to be a part of the community? They don't want to be a part of the community. That's not their model. They're a business. Their model is that they're going to make stuff and sell it to you, and that's all the interaction you're going to get. Which is, I mean, it's not my preferred model, but it does kind of work for some people. So are there answers? And it turns out, yeah, there are really cool answers out there. There's basically, I'm going to say three answers, but, actually there are a lot of answers now that I'm thinking about it. I was going to say three, with two actually being valid, but I guess there's probably like four, with three being valid. So the first one that I want to mention is something called AppImage, which you can find over at portablelinuxapps.org. And you might think, oh, this is those portable app things. Well, yes, it is, portablelinuxapps.org. That would be a portable app thing, but it's not the one that you think. So there were portable apps being built at one point, and it worked quite well. I don't remember exactly what what they were using. This one, PortableLinuxApps.org, it's really, really interesting. It is based very explicitly off of the model of Mac OS X and their .app distributions. So if you're not aware, on OS X, they have folders containing a binary and a bunch of resources and libraries and icons and things like that. And if you put the extension .app at the end of such a folder, you might have to do some other stuff, I don't remember, but that becomes, the computer sees that as an icon, and when you double-click it, rather than opening a folder, it executes the code inside of that folder in a certain order, in a certain way, and launches the application. So that's what AppImage does, essentially. And what AppImage leverages is the ISO image. So like every app image essentially is an ISO image. And when you double-click it, it mounts and executes code inside of itself and runs your application. It's really, really slick. You should check this out. PortableLinuxApps.org. It's not so much a collection of portable apps. It's more about how to create these on your own. And we'll probably do a demo of that at some point. Not today. Maybe. I don't know. Haven't decided. But it's a really, really cool system that you should take a look at. The disadvantage of it, I guess, is that it results in larger downloads. Think 100 megabytes instead of 10. So it's orders of magnitude. The example that's probably easiest is GIMP. GIMP, if you go and install it from a repository on your Linux distribution, I think it's like literally 11 megabytes. 11 megs. It's that small. If you go and download it as a portable app or for another platform, you're looking at over 100 megabyte download. And that's because the portable version of that has to bundle GTK and open Geggle, or just Geggle, maybe it's called, G-E-G-L. Lots of different things that GIMP needs to use in order to work. So that's the big difference between like an app image or a portable app and just a normal download. The other answer would be, and this is the wrong answer, is static linking. So I can hear you already, but I just told you it's the wrong answer. I'm aware of this. But I want to mention it because the concept is important to kind of to gather. So if we can look at some sample code really quick. And as you can see in this code, there's this include statement. There are these include statements. And what you can do in compiling something like this is you can make it so that where it says include, whatever, include foo, you can say, okay, I want you not to just like refer to foo on the system. I want you to copy or cat the contents of foo into my file that I'm compiling right now. So basically, it's just copying and pasting source code from where it exists on your system and pasting it into the application that you are compiling, and then you compile it and you send it to people. And it doesn't look anywhere for libraries. It doesn't depend on everything, on anything, because everything that it would depend on has been copied and pasted into the application. Seems like a really good idea. And for quite some time, I thought that seemed like a really reasonable thing to do. I mean, yes, it's going to result in a larger download, but it at least ensures that everything that it requires is included, in that download that you've just downloaded. So it turns out that there are security issues and reliability issues and memory management issues, all kinds of things with static linking. It's apparently like the worst thing in the world to a lot of people who know a lot more about this stuff than I do. So rather than try to argue with, the writer and maintainer of glibc, I'm going to accept on faith that static linking is a bad idea. So there you go. So that's not the answer, but there's something just as good without all of the security and memory management and whatever problems, and that is knowing your library paths and actually linking them intelligently. Now, this also is going to increase the size of the download, because while you're not like literally copying and pasting code out of like your system into the application that you're compiling, you do have to include the libraries that you want to rely upon, that you can't count on being on the target system. So you're and there are issues with that too, because if the code has a certain license that your code is not compatible with, that could be a problem, and you're redistributing someone else's library essentially. So there are issues with that, and it's a pity that such issues exist. Again, closed source stuff makes everything really, really complicated, but what can you do? Assuming we're doing open stuff, or assuming we're open enough to allow for this kind of linking, there are two things that you can do when you're compiling code to manage how stuff is going to run. So there's actually something that you can do to supersede something when it's running. Like when you launch an application, if you know that you have the exact correct library that it wants, you can actually tell it to look somewhere else for its libraries. I don't know who would ever do that. Like, as a user, I can't imagine maintaining my own set of libraries just so some application can run. It's an option, I guess. But you just you pass the LD underscore library underscore path variable on the command line, and then you launch the application. And then it knows to look in the LD library path wherever you set it. So you'd be doing like LD library path equals some location on your hard drive, and then it would know to look there when it's actually trying to run the application. So that works. The other way is rpath, and that's something that you do when you are compiling as the programmer. The library comes bundled with the application. It works. Like I say, there are a lot of licensing issues, potential licensing issues, depending on what exactly you are doing. But it's an option, and that's I think frequently one of the options that more closed source might want to look at. Although again, licensing, but you know, it's something that would potentially avoid all these kinds of like, oh, you've updated your operating system and now you don't have such and such a library anymore. Well, I don't care, because you have included that library with your download and now I can link to it. Now, the other way, like I say, you can do that with the LD underscore library underscore path equals, you know, I don't know, some specialized directory, and that way it looks there for all of its dynamically linked libraries that it's going to need in order to run the application. It's a lot like HTML, really. You know, like you're referencing an image somewhere in the file system, and so if you redefine where that file system exists, then it can look there instead. So, and there is an interesting project called Patch Elf, which is from the NixOS people, NixOS. If you go to nixos.org/patchelf.html, that allows you to actually change the R path of an existing binary with Patch Elf. I've not tried that personally. I've not tried that yet. It is something I want to look at, just kind of out of curiosity, but that is kind of cool. So I don't know. Those are the concerns when packaging things. I think that if people maybe thought a little bit harder about what is that target system going to actually have on it, and what do I need to include with my download, that might help. Giving the flexibility of you know, for a user to download those libraries separately. I've seen that happen on my old, you know, on the old OS that I used to use before Linux. there would be a lot of cases where that would exactly, that exact thing would happen. Even in Audacity. Like, I think the download of Audacity, you don't get lame lib or lib lame or whatever. And on, I think it's on some other OS, it pops up a warning and it says, hey, you don't have this open source thing installed. We can't give it to you, but here, if you click this button, we can go out and, you know, now we can download it for you, put it in the right place, and then start running. So that would be an option too. If you're that closed source and you're not, you know, your license is not compatible with someone else's license, you could RPath your library to some location within your executable binary folder. And then on the first launch, look in that folder. If it's not there, offer to download it for the user, pop it into that folder, and then go about running the application. It's a bit of a hack. I mean, it's one of those things, you know, it's a little bit mean-spirited, to be honest. But, I mean, if you're closed source and you want to package successfully for Linux, that's probably better than packaging something that relies on some old library that's not going to be around in 2 years and then just breaking. So that's my thought on the subject. Now, an app image would obviously be another option, so that's not a bad one. So finally, I think, I mean, just thinking about packaging and thinking about users, I think it would be cool, and this was just something I thought of as I was talking, I think it'd be really kind of neat if we had like a standardized package format agnostic shell command for package management. Or GUI as well. You can have a GUI version of it as well. And I think that PackageKit was supposed to be, I think that was supposed to be that thing. But I don't know that that ever sort of reached that goal. I don't know that it didn't, but you know, point being that I've noticed myself that, you know, someone's asking, hey, how do I install such and such? And you think, well, I can think of the yum command. I can think of part of the apt command, but not the diagnostic commands that I would need. I can think of the slacker command. Just can't think of, like, you know, this one. And it becomes like so confusing. And I wonder if it would be, I mean, I guess it would be possible. It would just be kind of neat to see, like, just one command that everyone could download, and it would be, it wouldn't care if it's an RPM, if it's a deb, if it's a URPMI, or I guess those are RPMs, but RPM, deb, is that all? No, we've got more than that. I'm sure there are lots more that I'm not thinking of. It wouldn't care, you know, it wouldn't care what kind of package it was, and it would translate it and install it. I think that would be really neat. And I guess, to a degree, there is Alien, and I keep forgetting about that. But I'm just talking about just something where we could say, yes, I'm going to list all the packages installed on my system. Well, run this command with this flag, and it will do that. That way you don't have to know whether it's a yum show or a yum info or a rpm-q-v or something. QA? I don't know. I don't know RPM that well. It wouldn't matter what system you're on. The application itself would figure that out and run whatever command behind the scenes that would then give you, you know, whatever, a list or the version of such and such, or what provides so and so, you know, stuff like that. I think that would be really cool. I was playing around with Zipper, Zypper, for an article that I wrote some time ago now. And I was really impressed with it. That one really seemed very advanced and very, very full-featured. But yeah, I think it'd be cool to have, one that would just work with all of the different package formats. And that way we wouldn't have to all remember yum and apt and zipper. But if you wanted to, you still could. But it would be like an additional thing. That's just an idea. So anyway, that's my thoughts on packaging. The takeaway points from this, I guess, for people who need this information would be app image and RPath. Those are the answers on packaging things for longevity and for reliability, for compatibility, and all that stuff. So hopefully that helped. Alright, hopefully you've got yourself a cup of coffee, because we're going to talk more about packaging, amazingly. This is Noob Corner. So, since we just analyzed all of the different ways you could package an application from, like, the developer angle, I figured it might be appropriate to analyze how to install stuff if you're a noob, and you don't know how to install things all that well, or you just want an overview of all the different ways, because there are a lot of different ways. So let's go over that now. The first way to install packages on Linux is going to be probably pretty familiar to you. And because Slackware doesn't really use this method, I'm going to use this virtual machine here just to kind of demonstrate the first one. So if you've ever used a phone or, you know, a recent iteration of an operating system, this is going to feel pretty familiar. So in this stock install of Red Hat, I don't have Inkscape, for instance, or come to think of it, GIMP, but we'll go with Inkscape because that's what I planned on. So traditionally, what you would have done, like if you're not on Linux, you would have opened up Firefox and you'd have gone to Inkscape.org, or you'd have done a search for Inkscape because you'd have heard of it, and you'd have been led to Inkscape.org, and you'd go to the download menu, and you can see that there is a place for Linux. So we'll go to Linux, and this is pretty typical when you're on Linux. This is the kind of message that you'll see. So the latest stable version, Inkscape, is prepackaged for most of the widely used Linux distributions. So your package manager or app store should be able to find one. So if you're using a modern operating system, there's probably this notion of an app store. In Linux, it's not really called an app store, and in Linux, it's been around for about 20 years. The phones and the modern operating systems have actually borrowed this idea from Linux. In Linux, it's always been called a package manager. So what we'll do is we'll abandon the idea of just clicking on something and downloading an installable package, because that's what you're used to. That's not going to happen here. Now, don't get me wrong, it does sometimes happen, but this is the more typical model for Linux. This is the preferred model. So there's usually some kind of application on your Linux distribution called adding or removing packages, or adding or removing software, or just, in this case, software. So this is the software application, and all we need to do here is pretend like we're online, because we kind of are, and we'll search for the exact same thing that we searched for in Firefox. And happily, there is an Inkscape result, and it's a vector-based drawing program, blah blah blah. So if I click that, do I need the documentation for it? Personally, no, I don't. Do I need a viewing program? That actually might be nice. I've never used that before, but I might as well try it. So here I've got two packages selected. If there were other things that I needed to install, I could search for those, and I could add those onto my install list. There's a bunch of stuff for GIMP. But for now, just to keep this simple, I'm going to click on this pending view, see that I've actually only got Inkscape selected, and then I'll click on this Apply Changes button up here in the upper right. And I've got a new pop-up window here that says that everything's installed, and it's even offering to run it for me. So I'll go ahead and click Run just to show you that, yes, it has installed. Oops, I clicked it twice. But yeah, there's Inkscape ready to be used. And it has been installed. So that's as simple as the basic install process is as simple as going to a little quote-unquote app store, searching for the thing, and telling it to install it. So this is the same thing, except this time I'm doing it in Linux Mint, and that's simply to show you that there are, you know, essentially the same concept, but things might look a little bit different. So this is Linux Mint XFCE, so I'll click on my little application menu, and I'm just going to search for the word software, because like I said, it's usually called something with the word software, either in it or associated with it. And on Mint, you can see that there's a couple of different options. There's Software Manager, Software Sources, which is completely different, well, related but different, Synaptic Package Manager, and then the GDebi Package Installer. So Software Manager and Synaptic actually do basically the same thing. But I'm going to show you the Software Manager because that's the significantly different application from the ones that Red Hat or CentOS ship with. So here you can see that it's a lot more colorful. It looks quite a bit nicer, to be honest. There are even subcategories, so I'm clicking on graphics, and then within graphics there's more subcategories, so I'm clicking on drawing. Here's Inkscape. So I'll go into the Inkscape category. It tells me that it's not installed. In this case, I'll just tell it to install. And the process is exactly the same. You can see right at the bottom of the window, it's telling me how much longer, you know, it's got a progress bar. So it's exactly the same. It just looks a little bit different. And there is a search bar here. Should have probably shown you that. I mean, you don't have to click on categories and figure stuff out. If you know exactly what you're searching for, you can just type it into the search bar up at the top or the upper right, and it'll search for the thing that you are wanting. Of course, not every package manager is going to have everything that you ever want. So the way around that is, well, there are a couple of ways around that. One is to add more options to your software manager. So there are a couple of places online that you can do that. The most ubiquitous one probably is RPM Fusion, and there are lots and lots of packages there, and there's really good instructions on how to add that to your system. They give you even like a single line command that you can just paste into your terminal and run, so it's fairly simple to use. There are lots of others. There's RPM Forge is the name of another one, and then of course if you're not using Red Hat or CentOS or Fedora, then you might look at other places that would be appropriate for your distribution, like Dev Multimedia or Pac-Man for OpenSUSE. The end result of all those things is that when you go to your software manager, you can now find a lot of additional packages that would not have been there otherwise. Red Hat isn't generally known for providing a bunch of sound applications, and yet if I type in Jack now, I get a lot of fairly pro audio kinds of results. Not as many as I would personally like, but you get the idea. And as you can see in the software sources in the left-hand column of the software window, there are now, since I've installed these separately, there are quite a few extra places to go and get software from. RPM Fusion, RPM Forge, EPEL. So you can add, you know, you can add more. This is just a window to a world of servers that house lots and lots of different applications for whatever distribution you happen to be using. That's not to say that you can't do it the traditional way, like the way that you're used to. Let's say we're looking for a package called Synfig Studio. Even if we went to, for instance, our software manager again, typed in Synfig, that shows nothing. There are no results for Synfig Studio. It's not in any of the package sources that I've added to this store. It's not in EPL, it's not in RHEL, it's not in CentOS, it's not in RPM Forge. So, again, traditionally speaking, with any other operating system, you would just go online and do a search for the software package that you're looking for. So I'm typing it into Firefox. So here's the website, the homepage. Go to the download link. There's a bunch of options here. And pretty much as usual, you've got a list of the different options. You've got Ubuntu, Fedora, Red Hat, and generic Linux binaries. We'll talk about generic Linux binaries in a little bit, but for now let's focus on this because they do have an installable package for our distribution. So I could download the 64-bit package and it would download itself into wherever I send my downloads. In fact, normally, and I'll try to, let me see if I can find something fairly small. So normally if I, here's a very small package called Beep from RPM Forge. So if I download this, Firefox actually offers to allow me to either save the file or open it with software install. So that's kind of a nice, that's a nice feature right there. You could actually just, you don't even have to really process the file. You can just click on an RPM online and then install it straight out of, you know, just wrap, as you download it, it will also install. So that's kind of a nice feature. It's not one I actually use that often. I tend to download first and then save it. That way, I have it on my system. So here's the Synfig binary. So if I click on this, again, my system kind of knows this is an RPM file. So that's an installer. So would you like to install a file? And so I can say, yes, I would like to install that file. It does what it needs to do. And now it's installed, so I'll close this window and I'll click on my little application menu and I'll go into applications. And I happen to know, I think initially I would probably look in multimedia. For whatever reason, Synfig classifies itself as a graphics application. Don't really know why, but that's fine. And there we go. That's Synfig Studio. This is actually the program I use for all the animations on this very show. Just FYI. There is yet one more way that you might find an application hanging out online. One of them is a self-contained binary. It's just, and this is exactly what I was talking about on the Synfig site, where it said you can download a generic Linux binary. For instance, if I go to my own personal binary folder, you'll see that there are a couple of applications in here that, I mean, the icon is kind of indicative that it's a little bit unique. It's this little gear. Of course, it won't be on that like that on every system. It depends on what icon set you have installed. But those essentially are what I'm talking about. So Blender is one such application. So if you download Blender the usual way, unless you build it yourself from raw code, this is what you'll get. And this, when you open it up, if you expect there to be an installer or something, then you'll be wrong. That doesn't exist. So there's just this Blender file, and I'm going to right-click on it and select Properties just so I can show you that the type is marked as an executable. And you can kind of see that it's fairly sizable. It's 97 megabytes, which for a Linux application, that's pretty unusual. Like if we go to, for instance, USRBIN, user bin, that's where all the binaries are kept, or a lot of the binaries are kept. And if we look at, let's look at GIMP, for instance. I'm assuming that's in here somewhere. Yeah, here's GIMP 2.8. I'm going to right-click on it and go to Properties again. And so once again, this is an executable. And look at the size. It's 5.5 megabytes. It's tiny compared to the Blender executable. And I mean, I would say that those two applications are fairly analogous in terms of size and complexity. Here's QTractor, a pretty complex sound application, a sequencer, a DAW, and it's an executable, and the executable is 2.9 megabytes, so that's even smaller. So, I mean, these are really, really small executables, and the reason for that is because Linux is really modular. So when you go and download something that is not modular, that says, here's a dedicated binary, and we're including a bunch of other stuff, then the overall size is going to be a lot larger. Does that really matter? Not really. I'm just letting you know that that's how this is done. This is a lot more, you know, you're downloading sizable packages rather than 11 megabytes for instance, a GIMP
download. Okay, so I'm going to click on this binary because that's what we really want to do. And look at that. It just launches Blender just like that. So that's pretty simple, kind of nice to be able to have just something that you can download and launch right off of your desktop. The slightly mildly annoying thing about that is that everything else in Linux doesn't do that. So, I mean, I have this folder called bin in my home folder, so /bin. And that's got all the different kinds of applications that I normally would, you know, I carry around with me, essentially. And that's very handy to have, but unless you manually add it to your menu, then you're probably not going to really find it that convenient that every time you want to launch a certain application, you have to go into your bin folder and then click into, for instance, Blender, and then click on the Blender application. Wouldn't it be so much easier if you just clicked on the same application menu that you always click on and found the thing and ran it from there? And there are a couple of different ways to do that, and it's actually really simple. So one way is to add it manually by right-clicking on your menu editor. At least this is how it's done in KDE. I think it's similar in other desktops as well. Menu editor. And you can actually just kind of add your own ad hoc .desktop files is really what you're doing. And it doesn't have to be anything fancy. You just give it a name. You give it like a little description, maybe a comment if you want, and then the command that you need it to issue in order to launch. That's what that looks like. So, of course, the problem is that in this case, if we just type in Blender, this is probably going to work. Oh, good, it doesn't. It doesn't work. It doesn't know where Blender is because it hasn't really been added into where your .desktop files are, right? Which is here. So it doesn't really know where that is, and it's not in the usual path. So it has no clue where exactly the Blender executable is. You'll notice that my binary folder is in my path, but there's no executable. Like if I go to bin, the only Blender there is actually a directory, not an executable. And I could fix that easily, but that's not really what I'm talking about right now. So what we'll do is we'll locate the Blender binary, which is in the Blender folder, and there's the Blender binary right there. So if I launched Blender here, that would work, take my word for it. And here is home SXE bin Blender. So now if I go, I'll just show you where this Blender thing is, if I can find it. Here's Blender, and as you can see, the command that I've entered there wasn't just Blender. It's /home/SXE/bin/Blender/Blender. So that's how it knows how to launch Blender, because I gave it the full path. Now, the other way to do that, of course, is to simply add a .desktop file yourself. And I don't have one for Blender, so obviously, but let's see if I have one for Synfig. No, I don't seem to have one for Synfig either. Well, GIMP. So I've already shown you how to do this, so I'm not going to do that in another episode, so I'm not going to do it right now. But this is a .desktop file. It's pretty simple, and it's really basically what we just did in that menu, and that's nice. And the nice thing about the .desktop file is that it's desktop-wide. Like, if I only add it to my KDE menu, then it'll only ever show up in KDE. So if I'm using Fluxbox or some other desktop, then its application menu would not propagate that. So it's kind of better and more universal to make your own .desktop file. Now, you don't have to keep everything in, you know, all your exclusive downloads. You don't have to keep them in /bin. That's kind of a tradition or whatever. But it's kind of nice because you don't have to be root to install things there. So you can do that. But the other common place to do that is /opt. And the advantage to slash opt is that all other users on your system could then use the binary there, if you have other users on your system. This being Linux, of course, there is always a way to do everything that I've been doing in the, everything I've shown you so far, really, there's a way to do all that stuff in a shell, which is very handy. So, if we, for instance, become root, and use some, whatever command, so on different distributions, it's going to be a different thing. So yum is going to be on Red Hat, apt-get is going to be on Debian and Mint, zipper on OpenSUSE, urpm something on Magia, and so on and so on. They're mostly pretty similar. For instance, if I wanted to search for a package, I could say, okay, well, I want to search for something called GIMP. And there it's found all the results that contain GIMP in the name, and I could just do a quick yum install GIMP, and that will scan the network for the fastest server. And as you can see, as I was saying in the other application, it knows automatically that yes, you want to install GIMP, but in addition to that, you're also going to need to install all of these other packages, which is quite nice. So, and you can see, by the way, remember how we were looking at the GIMP binary and it was only like 5.5 megabytes? This is the total download of GIMP and all of its supporting applications is 18 megabytes, and then it decompresses those, uncompresses them, and by the end of the installation, it ends up being 73 megabytes. So that's about the size of that Blender binary. But it was, you know, it's just broken out in this model. So the reason that it knows how to find all of these things is because this is just another way of looking at this. They're both doing the same thing. So it's not that this is a different system or anything like that. This is the exact same thing happening. In fact, if you try to do these two things at the same time, it will tell you that you cannot do that because you're trying to literally do the same thing, and you're seeing it in a different way, in a different portrayal. So here's GIMP, and it will install all of these packages, and you're doing it in a little window. And in this sense, in this style of doing things, you can just do it with text. And it's maybe faster for you, maybe more convenient, you don't need a GUI for it, you can script it, and so on. Of course, there are other commands that I probably shouldn't go into, but, you know, there's search to find something, install to actually install it, and then, you know, usually there's something about removing that package, so that if you want to get rid of it, you can do that. And, you know, I mean, each different front end is going to act a little bit differently and have different ways of doing things, but they're all pretty fully functional, and that's kind of a nice option to have. So realistically, that's probably the thing that you're going to usually come across in your everyday life, but there are other ways to install applications, and so I figured I should probably at least mention them. The other way, and I think the historically accurate, you know, this is the traditional way of doing things, is to just install from source code, meaning that in the old days, or the modern days, if you run a system the way I do, you would go out to the internet, or, you know, to a server anyway, on the internet, and you would download the source code. And when I say source code, I mean, you know, like source code, like this. This is source code. This is C++. So you would download this, and then you would run it through a compiler. And it would build it like that. or somewhat like that. And then when it was finished doing all of the things that it needs to do here, you would then run a make and a make install command, and that would distribute it out onto your system. Okay, so the thing about that, though, is that if you want to remove something from your system, like, for instance, we just pretended to install LMMS, which is the music software. Well, it just so happens that LMMS is about 23 megabytes, it looks like. And look at all these. This is a list of all the files that are associated with LMMS. Okay, I'm not going to scroll through it all because, as you can see, there are 2,300 lines in this list. And that's a lot of files. So if I wanted to uninstall LMMS, and I had just installed it the way that we pretended to install it, I would have to go out to every single location, and I wouldn't even know the locations. I would just have to guess and just start deleting folders. Any folder with the word LMMS in it, I guess. So what they decided to do at some point, and as far as I understand it, it kind of started with the BSD people, was come up with a way to let people download the source code, but also have some little helper scripts that would build it for them and kind of keep track of what they built, and provide a way to either update or remove the software that they had built. And that's what the port system kind of pioneered, and that's very, very handy. And other places have emulated that as well. And that's very handy, and other places have emulated that as well. So you have things like, slackbuilds.org. That's pretty much all it is little helper scripts that will help you install applications, but such that you do not have to do it without really recording that you've done that. Gentoo Emerge, from what I understand, is very, very similar. Arch AUR, the Arch User Repository, from what I can tell, is really, really similar. It's just a bunch of build scripts. So it's ways to install from source code, but to have it a little bit moderated. And it's really not that difficult to do. For instance, let's go to this one, because I know this is a small application. So in this case, since I have this collection of helper scripts, I can do things like find out there's no source code in this directory. So this is a Slack build. This is what I call my Slack build tree, and it's got all of the scripts. So there's no source code in here. This is just the scripts. So for instance, if I told it to build this application for me, at this point, it would tell me that it can't do that. It would produce an error, because it's telling me, you don't even have the source code. How can I build it for you? Here's the download link provided for me in a little text file, which is kind of handy. And so I can download this thing. And now that it is downloaded, I can run the build script, which in this system is called the Slack build. And as long as that's executable, which it is, because I had just made it executable, I can just do a .slash, in this case, ophcrack.slackbuild, and it does the configure. And now it's building. Okay, so what this has done, as you can see, it kind of lists, or here, if you're just listening to this episode, it just lists all the files that will be installed, should I choose to install this, because all I've done right now is build. And with this application called install pkg, I can actually commit it to my system. And so now if I, normally I shouldn't be able to just type in ophcrack and have it launch an application, but now I've just installed one. So yes, it does actually install the application as one would expect. So there you go. That's installing from source code with helper scripts. It's a lot simpler than installing from source code directly. It's a lot cleaner. as well. And I say simpler because that means someone else, some poor sucker, has already gone through the source code and figured out what needs to happen with it in order to make it run correctly on your system. Which, you know, sometimes, I mean, with OPH crack, for instance, there was really nothing to do. I know this because I packaged it up for Slack builds. But in other applications, like I think I saw a bunch of patches. Yeah, see, in LMMS, for instance, you've got, like, two patches here. So there you go. That's the idea behind installing from source code. We have traditional Unix to thank for that, and for my money, that's the way to go. So as with any operating system, you're kind of at the mercy of the developer who is giving you the software that you have downloaded or purchased in terms of what the installer is actually going to look like. So everything that I've kind of shown you so far has been mostly stuff that is directly, you know, from kind of like the Linux crowd, as it were. You know, there's been an intermediary a lot of those times. And sometimes you're dealing with a completely different sort of set of people who maybe aren't as invested in the infrastructure of kind of like how Linux delivers software. So in this case, here's a game that I got from the Humble Bundle, and so it's Penumbra Overture, and I click on this shell script, not really sure what to expect, and pops up this little terminal, and it looks like it's uncompressing an archive or something, and it's got this little this sort of hand-rolled installer. So it's pretty obvious, you just kind of click Next, agree to their licensing, which is that it's not GNU GPL, it's you know, something else, it's closed source, I'm assuming. I'm not going to read it, actually, paid for it, I don't care. And then I'll put this into, I guess, let's do user local games. And it detects that I don't have permissions for that directory, so I'll continue as root. It warns me that this is actually going to install an application. I should probably really think about this. And then I could click OK, and then it would install the application. And I'm not going to do that. So yeah, you'll run across different installers depending on where you've gotten your software. And it's always important to be kind of smart about where you are getting software. You don't want to just download it from any old place online. But as long as it's a trusted source, you feel good about it, then installing it, now that you know all the different ways that you could possibly and potentially install software, should be more or less a breeze.
And that about sums it up, I think. And I think it also brings us to the end of the episode. So thank you for watching. Thanks for talking to me, as it were, about packaging. Hopefully you learned something. And it's been fun. I'll see you next time.
Okay, I think that's it for this episode. Thank you very much for listening, as always. My name is Klaatu. You can find me online at GNUWorldOrder.info or at SlackerMedia.info. You can find me via email at klaatu@member.fsf.org. That's member.fsf, as in Free Software Foundation.org. And you can also find me on LinuxQuestions.org as not Klaatu. Thanks for listening. I'll talk to you next time.
Jet Age is now here.